Tantor Audio, a division of Recorded Books, presents Mighty Bad Land. A perilous expedition to Antarctica reveals clues to an eighth continent. By Bruce Landyke. Forward by Edward J. Larson. Narrated by Christopher Grove. Always go a little further into the water than you feel you're capable of being in. Go a little bit out of your depth. And when you don't feel that your feet are quite touching the bottom, you're just about in the right place to do something exciting. David Bowie, musician, artist. Forward by Edward J. Larson. Over 120 years ago, in 1901, sailing aboard the purpose-built Whirl research ship Discovery, the first major scientific expedition launched to winter over below the Antarctic Circle, headed from England to New Zealand, and then over 4,000 kilometers further south to Antarctica's Ross Island, near the present site of the United States National Science Foundation's McMurdo Station. Captained by Royal Navy officer Robert Falcon Scott, and funded by the British government, the Discovery carried teams of researchers charged with specific tasks by leading British scientific associations. Chief among their assignments, the expedition's geologists would look for fossil evidence, documenting the former connectiveness of the world's southern continents in the deep past, and a record of climate change. At that time, no one knew if an actual Antarctic continent existed. During the 1800s, naval exploring expeditions and some ambitious whalers had discovered land south of the Antarctic Circle. But these isolated discoveries could have represented parts of an archipelago of volcanic islands, rather than sections of a continental landmass. Dredging in the deep South Pacific during the 1880s, however, researchers aboard HMS Challenger had found sandstone, limestone, and other types of continental rock and sediment deposited on the ocean floor by Antarctic icebergs. This suggested the presence of a South Polar continent. Further, and of more pressing scientific significance at the time, biologists puzzled over the distribution of fossils among the southern continents. During the 1800s, researchers found fossil evidence of certain extinct species, such as the Glossopteris genus of seed ferns, from an earlier geological epoch in southern South America, Africa, and India. To account for the seemingly abrupt, widespread distribution of such species on now unconnected continents under an evolutionary view of life, Charles Darwin proposed that those continents once were connected in past times, perhaps through an Antarctic continent. Anti-evolutionists countered that the far-flung distribution of species constituted evidence of their divine creation. Although Darwin died before the Discovery expedition, his close friend and chief supporter among British botanists, Sir Joseph Hooker, threw his full weight behind it as a means to bolster Darwinism by searching for Glossopteris and other ancient fossils on the supposed Antarctic continent. Through arduous, death-defying research over 3 summers and 2 winters in Antarctica, researchers on the Discovery expedition found an ice-covered continental landmass on the mainland across from their Ross Island base, dry or snowless valleys among the trans-Antarctic mountains, the first documented evidence of sedimentary rocks and fossils on the continent, and widespread evidence of ancient climate change. Antarctica was once warm enough to sustain life, they concluded. Over the following decade, 2 more British expeditions, one on an aged, refitted sealer named Nimrod, captained by Ernest Shackleton, and another with Robert Scott, aboard a sturdy whaler called Terra Nova, built on this research, with Scott's second expedition finally finding the elusive Glossopteris. Researchers on these expeditions risked their lives on a regular basis, with the scientist who found the Glossopteris fossils, Edward Wilson, dying with Scott and his 5-person polar party in 1912. After finding those prized fossils at the Mount Buckley outcropping during their descent from the East Antarctic ice sheet, This team had carried them until their death from starvation, exposure, and exhaustion on the Ross ice shelf. A search party found their bodies in camp with the fossils and field notes. Despite radios, airplanes, snowmobiles, better supplies, and superior food, scientific research in the remote reaches of Antarctica remains challenging today. As a historian traveling under a grant from the National Science Foundation's Antarctic Artists and Writers Program, I experienced those challenges firsthand, working with dozens of different scientific teams during my season on the ice over a decade ago. It was there that I first met Bruce Landyke, then on his fifth expedition, whose geological research built on the century-old findings of the Discovery, Nimrod, and Terra Nova expeditions. As a historian, while I worked with various current research teams in the field, my project involved understanding and interpreting the work of those pioneering scientists on earlier expeditions, leading to my 2011 book with Yale University Press, An Empire of Ice, Scott, Shackleton, and the Heroic Age of Antarctic Science. Meeting Landyke gave me the chance to talk with a modern geologist, doing similar work as the Discovery, Nimrod, and Terra Nova geologists, and it helped me to confirm in my mind why their century-old research remains relevant today. Bruce Landyke's memoir, Mighty Bad Land, A Perilous Expedition to Antarctica Reveals Clues to an Eighth Continent, recounts the first of his three geological expeditions to mountain ranges in Marie Birdland, 800 miles east of the main American base at McMurdo Station. Marie Birdland, or MBL, is a remote area of West Antarctica that stretches east from the Ross Sea. Its scattered mountain ranges are distributed over an area about the size of California. Because Bruce's team worked beyond helicopter rescue range, they found themselves isolated in the deep field. Here, for a month and a half in 1989 to 1990, his small team of six persons sought evidence for the breakup of the Gondwana supercontinent and of a much larger ice sheet on Antarctica in the not-too-distant past, evidence that bears on the current rise of global sea level. As a memoir, Mighty Bad Land presents both a journey of geological discovery and an adventure story. In both respects, this book is similar to the memoirs written by Scott, Shackleton, and some of their leading scientists about their tales of living and working in the Antarctic. Like the scientists deployed by Scott and Shackleton, Landyke's team had to prepare to survive on their own. They were challenged, and sometimes unprepared for, the obstacles they faced. Biting cold, screaming blizzards, whiteouts, falls into deep crevasses, and bitter interpersonal conflicts. Like Shackleton's lead field scientist, Royal Society geologist Edgeworth David, Landyke was nearly 50 when he began his first Antarctic expedition. Burdened by age and asthma, he, like David, chose to risk the journey. Landyke's team consisted of four geologists supported by two mountaineers. Their combined skills and expertise were many, and in some cases, life-saving. The geologic team included a graduate student researching the origin of these mountains for her dissertation. Together, they lived and worked, discovered and protected each other from lurking perils. Today, ice-covered Antarctica sits centered over the South Pole at 90 degrees south latitude. New Zealand lies far to the north, halfway to the equator at 45 degrees south latitude. In the deep past, however, Antarctica and New Zealand were part of the same supercontinent, Gondwana. The early geologists traveling on the Discovery, Nimrod, and Terra Nova expeditions envisioned connections between these lands, but, assuming their locations fixed for all time, supposed that land bridges linked them in earlier geologic eras. Scientists today see continental drift as causing past connections and subsequent divisions. Both then and now, these scientists sought to test their ideas in the field. Even as the scientific answers change, the scientific method for seeking these answers remains much the same. Always questioning, always testing, no matter the risks, science advances one hypothesis at a time. A shared passion for truth, for the best answers, drives these researchers. Their stories make for compelling listening. New Zealand itself consists of two large islands and some smaller ones that stand as exposed parts of an expansive, shallow subsea feature named the Campbell Plateau. Recently, geologists have identified other submerged plateaus nearby that comprise sunken continental pieces of Gondwana. New Zealand represents a small part of the vast submerged regions that Landyke named Zealandia in 1995 while analyzing the results of their Antarctic expeditions. In recent years, scientists have confirmed his theory of this sunken continent using the name he gave it. Antarctica holds significant public awareness. 30 nations maintain research stations on Antarctica, bringing its summer resident population to some 4,000 persons, almost all scientists and their support staff. Only a precious few of them ever reach Marie Birdland, and most no longer face the dangers confronted by Landyke and his team. Mighty Badland tells the story of this modern team in a manner reminiscent of the old tales of derring-do of early Antarctic scientists who faced similar perils. This makes Mighty Badland a throwback of sorts. Unlike most recent books on Antarctica, the listener becomes embedded with Landyke's team and experiences firsthand the challenges, companionship, failures, bravery, cowardice, and success that scientific research in an unforgiving place brings to light. Bruce takes listeners with him to a pure wilderness experienced by few humans, a place where unseen menace waits everywhere. Listeners will learn why Marie Birdland, named for the wife of mid-20th century Antarctic aviator Richard Bird, has earned the nickname Mighty Badland. Mighty Badland is an unvarnished account of a scientist and his team exploring one of the most remote, wild places left on Earth. Now retired, Landyke tells this story firsthand. Listeners will learn from him what kind of people do science at the uttermost end of the Earth, and how they do it. They will follow his team and see his personal challenges on their first expedition. They'll find the answer to the question, what does it take to prevail in Antarctica today? It takes the same sort of grit that it took 120 years ago from scientists traveling on the Discovery, Nimrod, and Terra Nova. Welcome aboard. Preface. Ice is the beginning of Antarctica, and ice is its end. As one moves from the perimeter to the interior, the proportion of ice relentlessly increases. Ice creates more ice, and ice defines ice. Stephen Pine, The Ice, A Journey to Antarctica. The ocean itself is blue, but a thick white ocean of ice buries the continent of Antarctica. Near the continent's margin, mountains jut through the edge of the ice to reveal the secrets of what lies beneath. What does it take to discover these secrets? What drives a person to take on such a quest? What does Antarctica demand in return? My memoir is an exploration of the inner man in the most remote place in the world, where 0 degrees Fahrenheit is a warm day. Grandeur stirs disbelief, and in summer, there is no night. On January 6, 1990, racked with fear, I stood alone on the snow of Marie Birdland in West Antarctica. I watched helpless. In the distance, members of my small team attempted a rescue of two of us, who had disappeared into a crevasse. We didn't intend to risk our lives while we explored the remote reaches of the Ford Ranges. Near misses happened with blizzards, ice falls, and crevasses. Our team of one woman and five men sought secrets of an intriguing geologic event that formed a sunken continent long hidden beneath the waters of the South Pacific. A continent of scattered pieces, including the nations of New Zealand and New Caledonia, now known as Zealandia. In Marie Birdland, that is, Mighty Badland, we searched for evidence of how and why large bits of Gondwana ripped off from this part of Antarctica and then submerged as they drifted north. My project role, the expedition leader, which secured funding from the U.S. National Science Foundation, or NSF, to solve this puzzle. It had taken two tries over a span of 2 years to get approval. Now we found ourselves 800 miles from the main base at McMurdo Station, alone. Imagine flying from Los Angeles to Denver, passing over a vacant frozen wilderness, arriving to find nobody and nothing there, then living and working on your own in the wilderness. Remote expeditions such as ours carry the label Deep Field. That means beyond helicopter rescue range. Unlike in Antarctica today, we didn't have GPS, internet, faxes, satellite phones, or even walkie-talkies. We didn't have resupply. Our only link to humanity, a 20-watt shortwave radio. After the NSF approved what would be our two expeditions, I discovered more about the scale of effort we'd need. Information trickled in from Antarctic veterans that showed me the complications, risks, and dangers ahead. Their message? In Antarctica, mistakes are not forgiven. I'm asthmatic. The NSF rejected me for this project until I took a cold air exercise test to prove I could tolerate the conditions I would face. These conditions included exertion in cold, dry air, known triggers for asthma attacks. After some time in the mountains, my anxiety for our safety threatened to overwhelm me. Afterward, I met with our lead mountaineering guide. He told me not to come back for the next expedition. I didn't have the steel to deal with the danger and chaos of Antarctica. I considered this advice, but in the end resolved that I was the leader. I faced my fears and returned. In time I realized the splendor of what we saw in the wilderness of ice, rock, and sky, what we lived through and became part of. I fell in love with a continent. In this story, I deal with scientific topics at a level for an average listener. I reveal them in the dialogue and portray them with our actions. We made discoveries about the link between mountain building and Marie Birdland and the origins of Zealandia, about a larger West Antarctic ice sheet that existed in the past. Today, research in the Antarctic has a sharp focus on climate change. At the time of this story, 1989 to 1990, plate tectonics occupied the forefront. Climate change had only started to get popular recognition the year before, with the testimony of James Hansen to the U.S. Congress. Nevertheless, we encountered effects of a warmer Antarctica even in 1989. The events described in this book comprise my recollection and my interpretation. I have used my personal journals, notebooks, and photographs taken by me and by others on my team to build the foundation. In places, I may have mistaken one person's actions for another's. I changed the names of a few people or did not state them. I usually did not record dialogue in my journals. However, I recall some of what we said to this day. I affirm that most of the dialogue in this book and those I attribute it to fit my memory. In some cases, they could have said it, as it was appropriate to them and the situation. But it may not be so, or they may not have said it exactly as I remember it. A few scenes are moved in time and place. This book is not a work of journalism. I represent the actions of myself, my team, and others to the best of my documentation and memory. Chapter 1. Point of No Return. We have two or three great and moving experiences in our lives. Experiences so great and moving that it doesn't seem at the time anyone else has been so caught up and so pounded and dazzled and astonished and beaten and broken and rescued and illuminated and rewarded and humbled in just that way ever before. F. Scott Fitzgerald. Christchurch, New Zealand, to McMurdo Station, November 21, 1989. Places exist on Earth where no human is gone. Many are unknown, or invisible and inaccessible, like the floor of the ocean. Places of unspeakable beauty, frightening to our imagination. They draw us to them, as if by an extra pull of gravity. They mesmerize. Few of us get the privilege to visit. The opportunity to explore such places rarely presents itself. To go to them is hard work. At these places, sudden menace can confront and test you. These places change your life forever. You never really leave them. The last place on Earth is Antarctica. I had nurtured a dream of going, decided to take my chances. And now I was on my way, charging south, flying on a Hercules to the bottom of the world, and the ice. "I want to see Antarctica from the cockpit," I shouted to Tucker, Steve Tucker, my friend, and one of our mountaineers who sat next to me. "We must be close now." My message to Tucker had to penetrate through the yellow foam earplugs we wore to suppress the din. I timed my visit to the flight deck so I could see Antarctica for the first time. I put down Texas and twisted out of my seat to stand up and stretch out the kinks. We and 20 or so passengers were planted in red web seats on fold-up aluminum frames that stretched along both sides of the Hercules cargo hold. We sat on these, crammed hip to hip and knee to knee. A parallel center row in the aircraft held a dozen more, including Steve and Dave, two of our expedition team, across from us. Dave Kimberow sat in the center row asleep, his large knees arranged to avoid mine. His red parka pulled over his head made a small tent. The guy could sleep anywhere. Lucky him. Tucker and Dave seemed relaxed, reading and napping. I wasn't. As the leader of my first of what would be two expeditions, my mind swarmed with several to-do lists, most of which proved later to be off target. Dave and I, geologists and professors, planned this research project a few years back. It took us 2 years to get approval and funds from the U.S. National Science Foundation, NSF, a federal agency, to get to this point. I reflected on who had committed to the project, to me, to our team, the NSF, Antarctic Program Staff in the U.S. and Antarctica, U.S. Navy aircraft and crews, our university, and our families. I didn't attempt to put my mind around the total cost. It was a lot. These facts awakened the burden of the expedition on me, the scale of the investment made by those who decided to take a chance on us. We wouldn't get a do-over, but we'd be held to account. Like the NASA aphorism, failure is not an option. Now we began our mission, to explore and discover, to find out when, how, and why the southern supercontinent of Gondwana split apart, leaving Marie Birdland, MBL, in Antarctica, while scattering continental pieces, including the island nation of New Zealand, across the South Pacific. Important parts of the story demanded answers. Did the Earth's crust stretch so much during the split as to build the mountains in MBL? Why had mountains formed there while the continental pieces on the New Zealand side sunk below sea level? Why was the result not the same? Understanding the plate tectonic processes required answers to these fundamental questions. We, as geologists, plan to unearth the secrets of Marie Birdland to find them. We'd do that in the mountains of the Ford Ranges, far into the wilderness of Antarctica. I stepped between the knees of the other passengers who sat alongside and across from us and turned each foot sideways to slip my oversized white rubber bunny boots between legs. With each step, knees bumped knees. I made my way forward. At the entrance to the flight deck, I met the legs of a crewman above me. "Hello, can I come up?" He waved okay. The Hercules, a New Zealand Air Force C-130, with four colossal turboprop engines could glide through the sky like the best of them. Our aircraft approached Antarctica from over the Southern Ocean. I climbed up a few steps. A brilliant sky met me. After the murky cargo hold, my eyes needed time to adjust to the blinding brilliance, my ears to the quiet of the flight deck. The aircraft floated in the sky. Excitement caught in my breath. The pilots sat at the front of the cockpit, the engineer behind and between them in a jump seat. The navigator sat at an instrument panel to the right rear. He looked up at me and smiled. What a bunch of good-looking guys, young and healthy. Made me feel a bit insecure, pushing 50 years old and trying to hide, even ignore, my asthma. They wore green uniforms with the New Zealand Southern Cross flag on the shoulder, headsets for communication, and, of course, aviator glasses. Flight instruments covered ceiling and wall space. Floor-to-ceiling windows wrapped around the cockpit, yielding wide, startling views. Immediately, I sensed a moment of inspiration ahead. The pilot dropped our altitude, and then flew the Hercules over the coastline. An inconceivable expanse of white stretched ahead and beneath us. Ice reached beyond the horizon. Pure snow below a vivid blue sky. Glaciers spread out like rivers and tributaries. Steep, pointed, dark, majestic peaks jutted up from the blanket of snow and ice. I imagined myself as the first person to discover this amazing scene. I became still, lost in that thought. In the distance, the ice dominated. The immense Antarctic ice sheet buried the highest peaks, ignored their existence, made them disappear. I visualized the continent without it. Ice wasn't always here. It started to grow and then bury the landscape over 30 million years ago. The continent had sucked up a good part of Earth's oceans to form this white blanket. Sea level had dropped over 200 feet to build the ice. What triggered that change? From a warm greenhouse Earth to the present-day ice house Earth we live on. I dwelled on that deep mystery. Soon I would step foot on the landscape below, as a geologist and explorer, finding answers to fundamental questions about the breakup of continents. A thrill came over me, mixed with a wisp of dread. I flashed for a moment on the stories I had read and heard from the veterans. The warnings of danger and death. The scene before me looked alien, not of Earth. So overpowering was this vast, vacant expanse, a white ocean of ice with scattered islands of rock. This moment so special, this sight a beauty beyond explanation, its impact on me profound and not expected. I knew my Antarctic adventure would not be topped in my life. I knew I'd carry it with me forever. A warmth flowed into me with that realization. I recalled my elementary school teacher's finger scanning various places on the world map hung in front of the chalkboard. Continents, countries, capitals. I knew them all at the time. I noticed a thin, ragged, white strip running along the bottom of the map. The coast of Antarctica. And wondered what more lay beyond the bottom edge. At recess, I inspected the map up close. "Where's the rest of the world down here?" I asked. She pointed to a small, circular inset map in the lower corner. "If you could fly above the bottom of the world and look down, you would see Antarctica, a land covered in ice." "Wow! How big is it?" "As big as the U.S. and Mexico put together." She pointed to those countries. Antarctica looked like an enormous white duck. The Antarctic Peninsula jutted out, forming a duck's bill to nibble on the tail of South America. The duck's back, the south edge of the Pacific Ocean. Its belly facing the Indian Ocean. Many parts had the label, "Unexplored." Marie Birdland labeled the duck's head. "Who's she?" I asked, pointing to the name. "That's Admiral Bird's wife," she said. He discovered that part of Antarctica in 1929.
Sample complete. Ready to continue?